Welcome to Studio Tulsa on Health. I'm John Schumann, sitting in for Rich Fisher. The war on cancer was declared by President Richard Nixon in 1971 when he signed the National Cancer Act into law. It's been a long battle waged on many fronts in universities, hospitals, government labs, and private industry. While we've made progress in fighting cancer, which is the number two cause of death in the U.S., there is still a long way to go. Many types of cancer remain invariably fatal to those afflicted with them. Perhaps the greatest success we've had in the war on cancer so far is in one particular area, the treatment of chronic myeloid leukemia, or CML. The story of CML is told in a new book called The Philadelphia Chromosome, A Mutant Gene and the Quest to Cure Cancer at the Genetic Level, by freelance journalist and blogger Jessica Wapner, just published by The Experiment, a nonfiction publisher with the slogan, "Because every book is a test of ideas." Wapner blogs for the Public Library of Science, or PLOS, and has had articles published in the New York Times, Scientific American, Slate, Science, Nature Medicine, Ode, Psychology Today, and elsewhere. Her writing on cancer research and treatment also appears in the specialty magazines Oncology Business Review, Cure, and CR. The Philadelphia chromosome refers to an abnormal translocation between two of the 46 human chromosomes in which a piece of chromosome 9 and chromosome 22 break off and switch places with each other, resulting in the development of the malignant condition CML. In the book, Wapner recounts in suspenseful fashion the chromosome's discovery and the myriad steps that led to the development of our most non-toxic direct cure in the cancer world, the oral drug Gleevec. Jessica Wapner, welcome to Studio Tulsa on Health. Your book is wonderful, and it reads like a suspense thriller in terms of the many discoveries that led to, first, to define the Philadelphia chromosome, and later to find treatment for CML, chronic myeloid leukemia. What is meant by the Philadelphia chromosome? How did it get that name?
So the Philadelphia chromosome is a genetic mutation, and it's named after the city where it was discovered in 1959. Two scientists named Peter Knoll and David Hungerford were working at the University of Pennsylvania and Fox Chase Cancer Center, and it was really just a lucky discovery. Peter Knoll had found a way to expand cells in a way that enabled people to look at chromosomes. They were more expanded than people had been able to see up until that time. David Hungerford was this scientist who just loved looking through the microscope. He loved to see what he could see. And one day, he was looking at cells from patients with chronic myeloid leukemia, which is a rare and fatal cancer of the blood, and he noticed that one of the chromosomes was too small. It was amazing that he spotted it. Not many people in 1959 could have seen such a thing. Just there wasn't the training available. Very few people were doing what David Hungerford was doing. So he saw this genetic abnormality in patients with CML. And then it took decades to figure out what the connection was, whether that genetic mutation was causing the disease or whether the disease was leading to the mutation or whether it was just along for the ride, basically.
And what really struck me about that is it just was science sort of in its most pure form. I mean, it was this observation that was made about this slight difference in the size of a chromosome. And again, as you point out, there really we didn't know what the implication of that would be. What were the next steps in trying to tie the Philadelphia chromosome to CML?
Yeah, well, what happened in 1959 was that there wasn't very much more anybody could do, because there were microscopes, and that was pretty much it. There wasn't any technology to do anything further, to figure out what was going on, to look deeper inside the mutation. It wasn't until 1970 that that became possible. At that time, a scientist named Janet Rowley at the University of Chicago kind of picked up the baton and used a technique called banding, which was new at the time. It used as a fluorescent dye and a fluorescent microscope to not just look at chromosomes, but see inside chromosomes. And so with the banding, what it creates bands on chromosomes. You see these banding patterns, these stripes on every chromosome. And so your chromosome 22 would have the same stripes as my chromosome 22. But in patients with chronic myeloid leukemia, the stripes are different. And what Janet Rowley noticed at the time was that not only was there a difference in chromosome 22, which was the one David Hungerford had spotted, but there was something else going on. Chromosome 9 was too long. And so what she figured out was that there was something called a translocation, that two chromosomes were swapping a little bit of genetic material. And that was what the genetic mutation really was. And that's what was leading to chronic myeloid leukemia.
And this mutation, is this something that occurs due to an insult or smoking, or is this something that people are born with?
It is spontaneous. Nobody has found an environmental connection to this particular mutation. Of course, we know that can happen from carcinogens and such, but this particular mutation is just an accident of during DNA replication. All the time that happens in our DNA, just most of the time it's harmless or the mistakes go away. In this case, a spontaneously arising error ends up causing harm in the person.
Chronic myeloid leukemia, how common is it?
Pretty rare. It's diagnosed in about 5,000 people in the U.S. each year, and it is diagnosed in about one or two people per 100,000 in the world. So up to 75,000 people worldwide. To put that in perspective, breast cancer is diagnosed in about 230,000 people in the U.S. each year. If you look at cancer as a whole, it's about 1.6 million people in the U.S. diagnosed with any type of cancer. But I will say that, so, and I'm sure we'll get to talk about the drug that I write about in this book, Gleevec, because of the successful treatment, there's actually more people alive with CML than ever before, and it's ironically a good thing. It's the one disease where the incident rate increasing is actually a good sign.
So what's the natural history of a person afflicted with CML? Without Gleevec or without any kind of treatment, what would happen to them? And you write about this in the book, and it was, you know, I trained in the era when Gleevec had been actually released and functional, and so I never got to see what this was like, but you write about it.
Yeah, well, it was a nurse who described it to me. I was asking her, well, what would happen with somebody if they never got treated? And yeah, it's pretty harrowing. A person, just their blood, their marrow gets filled up with useless white blood cells. Right? Chronic myeloid leukemia is a disease where the body produces too many white blood cells that fail to mature. So there's not only too many of them, they're useless to the body. And it leaves no space for the healthy cells. So a person will become fatigued. That's sometimes the first symptom of CML. The spleen can get very enlarged, which will be painful. There's a lot of bone pain because of the marrow getting filled up with these useless white blood cells. Because of the lack of platelets, a person's blood would fail to clot, and eventually profuse bleeding would occur.
I thought that was the most haunting image, right? I mean, just inability to clot and then this crowding out of the marrow, so in a sense not being able to form red blood cells either, so more fatigue from less oxygen carrying capacity. And yet all of this has changed.
Yes,
so
that's right.
You mentioned the drug Gleevec. How does it work?
Well, I'll go back first to the Philadelphia chromosome and what was eventually found out about how that mutation leads to CML. And what happens is that the genetic mutation encodes a, the healthy gene, the healthy version of the gene, encodes a protein called a kinase. Kinases are enzymes that set processes in motion. You can hear it in the name kinase. It has the same root as kinetic, putting things into motion. So normally, this particular kinase helps give the signal to produce white blood cells. But our bodies don't need to produce white blood cells all the time, so sometimes it has a red light and sometimes it has a green light going. What happens with CML is the Philadelphia chromosome mutation leads to a mutant version of that kinase. And that mutant kinase is like haywire. It has the green light is always on, so it's always giving the signal to make white blood cells, which is why they fill up the body. So what happens with this drug, Gleevec, is that it blocks the kinase from giving that signal to produce white blood cells. So it targets the cancer at its root cause, not at the level of the gene, but at the level of the protein encoded by the gene. So it gets right at the heart of what is triggering the CML.
You're listening to Studio Tulsa on Health. I'm John Schumann, sitting in for Rich Fisher. My guest today is Jessica Wapner, author of the new book, The Philadelphia Chromosome, A Mutant Gene in the Quest to Cure Cancer at the Genetic Level. And Jessica, you talked about how Gleevec targets the molecule, really, at the molecular level, but not actually at the genetic level. First of all, just explain how this is markedly different from most types of cancer therapy that are still in use today for, you know, other types of cancer.
Yeah, it's so different, and that was a big part of the story, was the fact that this was a kind of a drug that had never been created before, never been tried out in patients before. Normally, I mean, we're all very used to hearing about chemotherapy, right? The side effects of chemotherapy, the hair loss, the nausea, the vomiting. Part of why that goes on is because chemotherapy is not targeted. Chemo means poison, so it's poison therapy, where basically you're trying to kill off the cancer cells before you cause too much harm to the person, before they just can't take the drug anymore. With this drug, it is targeted, so you're not targeting every cell in the body or the fast-growing cells in the body, which is what chemotherapy might target, if anything. It's this one particular mechanism that is at the root of this one particular cancer. So it's very, very specific, and it does not cause the kind of side effects that we tend to associate with somebody going through cancer treatment. It was also a vast improvement over what was available for patients with CML before, which was either bone marrow transplantation, which is actually still the only cure, technically speaking, but it's a very harsh process, and only about half of the people who go through it survive it, or a drug called interferon, which is like injecting your body with a flu virus, essentially. I mean, our bodies, all the symptoms we get when we have the flu is the natural interferon in our bodies trying to get rid of the virus. The fever, the aches and pains is all interferon at work. So when someone takes interferon, it's like walking around with the flu. People talk about sleeping for 22 hours a day, things like this. And again, this drug, Gleevec, that I talk about in the book, is just, it's nothing like that. It causes minimal side effects. And if a person takes this drug once a day, they can live a normal, healthy life.
And do we know the lifespan, or is it still too new in our armamentarium of treatments for cancer or for CML?
Yeah, I mean, every day is still an experiment, in a way, with this drug, because it was approved in 2001, and there are patients who are still alive, who were part of the first clinical trials that began in 1998. The current latest survival figures are at 10 years, survival rate is about 68%, which is very high.
And those that are not getting the longer survival, or the 32% that aren't at 10 years, is that because they're developing resistance to the drug?
I mean, it's hard to say what is exactly at play. Some patients do develop resistance to the drug, where the kinase develops other mutations and the drug stops working. And at that point, the cancer has progressed too much for other drugs to work. Because there's second and third generation versions of these drugs now. It could be that. It could be other problems arising. I'm not sure, if you dig into the data, whether some of those people are dying of other causes or dying of CML.
And Gleevec, you mentioned it's a once-a-day oral medication. It's a pill that somebody takes. There's no going to the infusion suite. There's no IV bags. And there's no, as you mentioned, no nausea, no hair loss. I mean, what a revolution in cancer treatment.
Yeah, I mean, I remember speaking with Brian Druker, who was one of the doctors that was instrumental in bringing this drug to patients. He was talking to me about what it was like to be thinking in the 1980s that such a drug were possible. You know, and he's saying to me, imagine I'm telling you that I can create a pill to treat cancer, and you can live a normal, healthy life without side effects. You know, it sounds like science fiction. And it does, you know, when you think about it like that. There's a pill. It sounds crazy, but it exists.
Can you share another Brian Druker story with us? I think you essentially opened the book with a story of one of his patients.
That's right. I talk about Gary Eichner and how he is he's a patient currently with Brian Druker. And what I love about Gary Eichner's story is that we meet him when he's undergoing a bone marrow biopsy 6 months into his treatment with Gleevec. And he ends up having an ideal response to this drug, which, of course, so many people do have an ideal response to this drug, right? I mean, every patient is like a dream patient for it. And we see that his bone marrow goes from containing 20 out of 20 cells containing the genetic mutation, the Philadelphia chromosome in a sample, to 0 out of 20 at 6 months. And part of what I love about Gary Eichner's story is that, you know, he doesn't know the history. He doesn't ever have to go through interferon or even consider a bone marrow transplantation. And it's all because of the story that I tell in this book. And he never needs to know about it, right? He doesn't need to read the book. And yet he's directly benefiting from 40 years of science and medical research and heroic efforts to get this drug to patients.
Really, it is an amazing story. And I alluded to the jigsaw puzzle-like nature of it. And you start with Noel and Hungerford, yeah, and then move forward to Dr. Rowley. You also mentioned Dr. Herb Abelson in the book. Mm-hmm. What's named after him?
Two things are named after him. There is a virus named after him, the Abelson virus, and also the gene known as ABEL, which is I mentioned that the Philadelphia chromosome encodes a kinase. And the gene involved in the Philadelphia chromosome, one of the genes, is ABEL, A-B-L, pronounced ABEL.
And where did his discoveries fit into the process of the drug development and this ultimate cure?
Yeah, his story is fantastic. He was a researcher, scientist in the 1960s, and what he explained to me was that at that time, there were a couple of options for doctors and scientists who did not want to go to Vietnam. And one of them was to get a job at the NIH, because that was considered being in the public service. But these were very coveted positions because of that. And so what happened is in the 1960s, there ends up being all of these really super talented scientists at the NIH because they did not want to go to Vietnam. So it became this sort of hub of research, in part because they could be in service there. And he was doing experiments. It was another example of somebody asking the right questions at the right time. He was studying a virus that caused cancer in mice. And he wanted to know what would happen if he removed the part of the body that the virus kind of lands on. So he did this in mice. He shut down the thymus in the mice. And what ended up happening was a new virus kind of arose spontaneously in the laboratory. If he were to repeat the experiment, there's no guarantee that such a thing would occur again. I wouldn't say it was a fluke, but it was a one-off thing, possibly. And that virus, which became known as the Abelson virus, became a focus of research because the origin of it was known and it caused cancer very fast, which made studying it in mice very easy. It was very conducive to laboratory research. And that was why people started using it. They were like, this is a great way to study how cancer forms in cells. That was the only reason why. But it turned out that the reason why the virus was causing cancer was because it had scooped up from the mice this gene called ABEL. And when it scooped it up, it mutated. ABEL changed form and became cancer-causing. And it turns out that the equivalent gene in humans was the one that was involved in the Philadelphia chromosome and led to cancer transformation in people.
You're listening to Studio Tulsa on Health. I'm John Schumann, sitting in for Rich Fisher. My guest today is Jessica Wapner, author of the new book, The Philadelphia Chromosome, A Mutant Gene and the Quest to Cure Cancer at the Genetic Level. We were talking about Herb Abelson, who discovered a virus that now bears his name, and how it was implicated in the causation of the Philadelphia chromosome. And you mentioned how, I mean, this story is one that's so fascinating and so, in a way, circuitous, because not only is it an innovation in medicine and science and cancer care, but then there's this whole sort of side process of advancements in laboratory science, I mean, in terms of how the processes are done. And so I think you go on from Herb Abelson to David Baltimore, who's a pretty well-known name in science, who valued this new pathway, right, for the rapid cycling time of studying cancer in animals.
Yeah, that's right. I talk about him being a New Yorker and being very impatient, as opposed to some other researchers that I chronicle in the book who were happy to take 7 years to make their big discovery. In his laboratory, people took this virus and started using it to unravel how cancer happened, right? That's what people, for many years, that's what people wanted to see. They just wanted to watch a cell go from being a normal, healthy cell to being cancerous. And a scientist named Naomi Rosenberg, who was studying in David Baltimore's lab, found a way to do that. She created a system, a transformation system, that enabled her and others to watch cells undergo this process when they were infected with a virus. And the virus, I mean, of course, in humans, most cancers are not driven by viruses. But for a very long time, viruses were a great way to study cancer because they are like a vector for carrying cancer into animals, essentially.
Now, you mentioned, well, several of the scientists and, in fact, several of the patients in the book. And I thought this was a very ambitious undertaking. I mean, how long did the project take you from, I guess, start to finish? Or what led to the idea to chronicle, really, the story of the Philadelphia chromosome?
Well, what led to the idea, I mean, I knew about the Philadelphia chromosome from working at a medical journal around the year 2000 or so. I would hear about it. It was around the time that the Gleevec data were first emerging. It was all very exciting. It was only several years later, when I became a freelance writer, that I started digging into the story a little bit more. And all of the science that we've been talking about was very fascinating to me. But what really made me want to put this into a book was all of the human stories. And when I learned about what had gone on when people had the idea to make a drug, what happened? What happened after that? The making of the drug, the story of this complete odyssey to convince a drug company to give it a try, to get it into clinical trials, to get it into additional clinical trials, even after it was showing this amazing response, I felt like that story just had to be told.
I'm curious, are there particular of the people you interviewed or parts of the story, people that you may not have been able to interview, that stand out as heroes to you in this journey?
Well, certainly Brian Druker is largely considered a hero in the CML community. People credit him with saving their lives, and he was, definitely. He was working 100-hour work weeks to try to get this drug into clinical trials, doing everything that he possibly could. I think there are also, there's a lot of heroes, including people at the drug company who were fighting for the drug to get made. There was a man named Alex Matter, who was the head of the group that was working on creating this kinase inhibitor, as this type of drug is called. And he was, he described himself as having this very combative personality. And he would go and stand up in meetings with all of the executives at the drug company and insist that they give this drug a try. There was a huge concern about how the drug would earn any money for the company, because as I said earlier, it's a rare disease. So the drug company was very concerned that they were going to put all of this money into making the drug and never recoup on their investment or make any profit from it. And there were also a lot of concerns about toxicity. At one point, a toxicologist says to Alex Matter, not over my dead body is this drug going into man.
Wow.
And Alex Matter, yeah, I know. I mean, it's crazy. It almost got shelved. It was so, so close to not being made. I mean, it is almost indescribable how if these people did not fight for it, the drug might never have been made. So there's a lot of heroes behind it, and including the chemist that made the compound, right? I mean, he wanted to make a difference where cancer was concerned. And he used his extraordinary talents with chemistry to produce a compound that could get into cells and block a single protein It's extraordinary what he accomplished.
Well, truth is always stranger than fiction, which is why I love nonfiction and why this story is so suspenseful, because you feel like the complexity, just in terms of the evolution, really, of the science over the years, leading to this amazing set of discoveries, really, that led to this first targeted therapy for cancers, you know, specifically targeting the type of cancer to lead to, you know, what amounts to a complete remission, although technically not considered that, is really just absolutely remarkable. And as you point out, at any step of the way, if one person had not carried the ball forward or persevered, it may have all sort of been shelved.
That's right. And none of the people who were doing the research were, like, trying to do it. You know, I try to convey this in the book. They weren't thinking, oh, let's figure out how this mouse virus leads to, you know, connects to a gene in CML. Like, it was all because people just were doing science that it eventually led to this complete picture of how the Philadelphia chromosome led to CML. And those people were not thinking, well, let's do our work because one day people will make a drug to target this. It just wasn't on anybody's screen.
What does Gleevec cost, or what did it initially cost, and did the drug company, in fact, recoup its investment?
Yes, they did. They definitely did, by multi-fold. So between the drug was approved in 2001, and between 2001 and 2011, sales of Gleevec totaled about $27 billion.
A nice day at the office.
Exactly. I mean, billion with a B. So that's quite a profit, for sure. And the drug was originally priced at about $30,000 a year. It was slightly more expensive than interferon at the time. They were rationalizing that, well, pricing it at around the level of interferon was reasonable because clearly people were already affording that drug, and this was an improvement, so it's a little more expensive. But the prices continued to go up, and as I said, there's also second and third generation drugs. Currently, a year of treatment on one of these kinase inhibitors for chronic myeloid leukemia costs about $100,000 per year.
My goodness. Jessica Wapner is a freelance writer and blogger, and this is her first book, The Philadelphia Chromosome, A Mutant Gene in the Quest to Cure Cancer at the Genetic Level, published by The Experiment. Thank you so much for appearing on Studio Tulsa.
Thank you very much for having me.
Jessica Wapner is a freelance writer and blogger and the author of The Philadelphia Chromosome, A Mutant Gene in the Quest to Cure Cancer at the Genetic Level, published by The Experiment. Well, that's our show for today. Studio Tulsa on Health is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. If you weren't able to catch today's or any of our programs, you can stream audio or hear archive shows at publicradiotulsa.org. Just find Studio Tulsa under the Program tab on our website. The views expressed on this program are those of our guests and do not necessarily reflect those of KWGS or the University of Tulsa. I'm John Schumann, sitting in for Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.